statute, at least those who are members of the International Criminal Court. And again, I think in broader political terms, this is of massive significance, despite all the shortcomings that I've just been discussing. This means that Israel's leaders indicted war criminals. And we heard the clip of Netanyahu once again trying to hide behind the Holocaust and what he claims is Israeli democracy and so on. That's no longer going to fly. That edifice has been peeled away. Israel will now be seen and judged on the basis of its actions in real time rather than on history in Europe.
What does this mean for the United States, for the U.S. main ally, Israel, its ally indicted on war crimes?
Well, I think that's another key issue. The U.S., of course, rejects the International Criminal Court and rejects its jurisdiction over this issue. But I think there's another key point here, which is all the threats that are being made by the United States, particularly most recently by a group of Republican senators, threatening all kinds of reprisals and retaliations against the International Criminal Court if it were to proceed with this measure. And this is a crime in and of itself. So it will be very interesting to see if the U.S. follows through on those threats, and if it does, how the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court will react. If I can just make one additional point. The reason we've gotten to this, to where we are today, is actually because of Hamas. About a decade ago, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, was coming under increasing Palestinian criticism and condemnation for dragging his feet on the Palestinian application to ratify the Rome Statute and become part of the International Criminal Court. He said he would only do so if he had the explicit endorsement to do so of the Hamas leadership. And it was only after he obtained that, that Palestine sought to become a state party to the International Criminal Court. So here you have a situation where it is the Palestinians who have been calling for an investigation of all crimes committed in what's called the situation of Palestine, whether by themselves or anyone else. And Israel and the United States categorically rejecting the court's jurisdiction and any measures that it may take.
Now, Israel and the United States are not signatories to the ICC, but right. I'm just looking at this New York Times article from last July. President Biden has quietly ordered the U.S. government to begin sharing evidence of Russian war crimes in Ukraine with the International Criminal Court in The Hague, according to officials familiar with the matter, signaling a major shift in American policy. And, of course, Russia also wasn't a signatory, and Putin was indicted. Talk about that kind of cooperation with the ICC in that case, but certainly not in this case.
Well, that's called the rules-based international order, where you apply international law and the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and so on to your enemies and adversaries, but you reject them for yourself and your allies, because there the rule is total impunity and to do as you please. And I should say that Karim Khan himself played a rather nefarious role in this. Upon assuming his position of prosecutor, he briefed the Security Council and informed the Security Council that he would only pursue those cases referred to him by the council. And that was a clear signal that he was no longer going to pursue the cases in Afghanistan and Palestine. He did so before Russia invaded Ukraine. Once Russia did invade Ukraine, that principle went out the window, and he basically did the bidding of those who had supported his campaign to become prosecutor. And I think it's also in that broader context that his continued ability to slowfoot and marginalize and ignore the situation in Palestine, particularly in the context of the current genocide, became untenable.
And can you finally tell us who Yahya Sinwar, Ismail Haniyeh, who lives right in Doha in Qatar, and Mohammed Deif are?
Well, I should add that Qatar is also not a signatory to the Rome Statute, and so therefore this should in principle not lead to Haniyeh's extradition to The Hague. Ismail Haniyeh is ahead of the Politburo of Hamas and therefore the titular leader of the organization. Yahya Sinwar is the leader of Hamas within the Gaza Strip, and at the same time is seen as the most powerful leader within the movement as a whole. And Mohammed Dif is the head of the Marjar Azzedine al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas. And Sinwar and Dif specifically are also seen as the main architects of the October 7th attacks in southern Israel and Hamas's military strategy in the months since.
Well, Muin Rabbani, want to thank you for being with us, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jalalaya and host of the Connections podcast, former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A high court in London has granted permission to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to appeal his extradition to the United States. The decision came after a critical hearing in London that Assange did not attend for health reasons. Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison for nearly 5 years, awaiting possible extradition to the U.S., where he faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Before that, he spent 7 years inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd been granted political asylum. In March, the court said if Julian Assange, who's an Australian citizen, could not rely on the First Amendment, then it was arguable his extradition would be incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights, which also provides free speech and media protections. In April, the Biden administration provided assurances to the court that Assange would not face the death penalty and that his First Amendment rights would be protected if he were to be extradited from Britain. For more, we go to London, just outside the British High Court, where we're joined by Chip Gibbons, Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent, covering the extradition hearing for Jacobin magazine. His recent piece for The Nation is headlined, End the Persecution of Julian Assange. Chip, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain what just took place in this last hour in Britain's High Court?
Sure. So in February, the Assange defense applied to appeal on 9 different grounds. In the UK legal system, you have to be granted permission to appeal. The High Court said they could potentially appeal on 3 of those grounds unless the U.S. made satisfactory assurances. The one ground was about the death penalty, and the defense agreed today that the death penalty assurance was satisfactory. The remaining 2 grounds, which they've now been granted leave to appeal on, meaning the U.S.'s assurances were not satisfactory, stem from a comment that Gordon Cromberg is in, a prosecutor in the Assange case. He also prosecuted Daniel Hale. He was involved in the Samuel Aryan prosecution. He's a notorious figure for his abuses of civil rights and civil liberties, said that the U.S. could argue that Julian Assange does not have First Amendment rights because he is a foreign national. This raised 2 grounds for appeal. First, that Assange would be prejudiced either at trial or sentencing due to his nationality, and that if he could not rely on the First Amendment, that violated his right to free expression under the European Convention. I will note that in that ruling, the UK High Court, the ruling in March, did not find that prosecuting Julian Assange for exposing war crimes would violate his free expression rights. And while they raised the death penalty issue, they also have asked the defense no longer to bring up the CIA plot to kill him, because if Assange is extradited to the U.S., then the CIA loses the reason to assassinate him. So Assange's defense basically had both their hands tied behind their backs and were given only the most narrowest of narrow grounds of appeal in what is the press freedom trial of the century. And against all odds, they have prevailed today, saying the U.S. assurances on the First Amendment, on nationality, are not sufficient. They accepted that the death penalty assurance was sufficient. There will not be an appeal on the death penalty. But what happened was the U.S. put forward this assurance that said Assange would not be limited in his defenses because of his nationality, and he could seek to rely on the First Amendment, but that was ultimately up for a court to decide. They also did not say that Gordon Cromberg or whoever else in the executive would refrain from bringing the argument that Assange had no First Amendment rights based on his Australian nationality. So the defense pointed out both that Cromberg is not refusing to bring this claim, and that a court could independently bring it, and that if a court independently brings it, that could be a free expression. The court could, independent of Cromberg, rule that Assange has no First Amendment rights. That could be a violation of his free expression rights, and that the assurance that he could seek to rely on the First Amendment is not an assurance that he could rely on the First Amendment. Now, the court today made no ruling about whether or not Assange can be extradited or whether or not this should block his extradition. They only ruled that there are grounds for an appeal based on this issue.
So what does this mean, Chip, exactly? What is the timeline here? Julian Assange has been in a maximum security Belmarsh prison for more than 5 years now. And before that, for years, he holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy. Though he'd been granted political asylum in Ecuador, in order to get there, he would have had to, you know, go through Britain, which means, you know, to fly to Ecuador, which means he would have been arrested. How much longer does this go on?
And I would note, Amy, that the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention found that Assange's time in the embassy constituted arbitrary detention. And as we speak, members of the UK Parliament, led by John McDonald, based on the journalism of Stefania Morici, are seeking to find out why the Crown Prosecution Service intervened in that Swedish extradition request in order to prolong it, the inference being they were setting him up to be extradited to the U.S. It's not clear to me how much longer this goes on. Assange will have another appeal about whether or not his free expression rights will be violated and whether or not his nationality will be discriminated against on the basis of his nationality. It's clear the judges were not very impressed with the arguments the U.S. and the U.K. put forward today. I don't quite know the timeline for that appeal yet. It's unclear. The defense and the prosecution have to work together to come up with some documents. And then, I mean, this could keep going on for a lot longer. And it's worth remembering that even if the UK courts eventually rule against him, which a lot of us felt like they were going to, given that they were basically telegraphing to the U.S. what they needed to say in these assurances, and the U.S. couldn't even do that, there's still the chance of going to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. So Assange remains confined in Belmarsh, one of the harshest prisons. We know his health is deteriorating. That's why he was not allowed in court today. We also know they have forbidden remote access to journalists who are not based in England and Wales because they can't be prosecuted for taking a screenshot of the hearing. That's why I'm in London and not in my house in D.C. watching this. And I suspect the reason why they won't grant these transmissions is they're afraid if Julian Assange does show up, someone will take a screenshot of them, because we know they don't want people filming or taking pictures of Julian Assange revealing the terrible shape that he's in. So this is a victory for Julian Assange and that he lives on to fight another day. His case lives on to fight another day, but he's not out of Belmarsh yet, and he's not in the clear yet. This could still end in him being sent to the U.S. And the person who can stop this is Joe Biden and Merrick Garland. They could drop these charges today. They keep claiming, oh, this is the Justice Department. We don't want to politicize the Justice Department. But this is a political prosecution. The choice to bring charges against a journalist for exposing U.S. war crimes is the choice to bring a political prosecution. It was a political decision when Barack Obama refused to bring the case, and it was a political decision when Trump and Sessions and Barr chose to bring it. And, you know, Biden can sit there and say he's not like Trump, he believes in democracy, journalism is not a crime, all of those sorts of things. But those words are extremely hollow so long as Biden continues to make the political decision to continue this Trump-era persecution of a journalist whose only crime is exposing war crimes, abuses of power, and state criminality.
Chip Gibbons, I want to thank you for being with us, Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent in London, to cover the Julian Assange extradition hearing for Jacobin. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined "End the Persecution of Julian Assange." When we come back, we speak with two more House professors. President Biden gave a commencement address at the historically black college yesterday. One of those professors put her fist in the air and turned her back on President Biden, protesting Gaza policy. The other held up a flag of the Democratic Republic of Congo behind the president as he spoke. Back in 30 seconds. Evangelism by Ethel Kane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, President Biden addressed the graduating class of Morehouse College, the prestigious black college whose alum include Martin Luther King Jr.
It's a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. That's why I've called for an immediate ceasefire. An immediate ceasefire to stop the fighting. Bring the hostages home. And I've been working on a deal as we speak, working around the clock to lead an international effort to get more aid into Gaza, rebuild Gaza.
President Biden's address came just days after his administration notified Congress of its plans to send another $1 billion in arms to Israel, including tank ammunition, mortars, and tactical vehicles. Some students turned their backs on President Biden to protest his Gaza policies. The Morehouse valedictorian, D'Angelo Fletcher, who had a Palestinian flag affixed to his graduation cap, called for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza.
Dr. King was a global philanthropist of social justice, believing that injustice was a threat to justice everywhere. His campaign and message reached far and wide to follow in the footsteps of our great alumnus. It is only right for the class of 2024 to utilize any platform provided to stand in solidarity with peace and justice. The Israel-Gaza conflict has plagued the people of its region for generations. It is important to recognize that both sides have suffered heavy casualties in the wake of October 7th. From the comfort of our homes, we watch an unprecedented number of civilians mourn the loss of men, women, and children, while calling for the release of all hostages. For the first time in our lives, we've heard the global community sing one harmonious song that transcends language and culture. It is my stance as a Morehouse man, nay, as a human being, to call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Hear the people of this world. Sing the song of righteous justice. Thank you.
President Biden was seen applauding D'Angelo Fletcher's valedictory, his call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Later on Sunday, protesters gathered in Detroit, where President Biden addressed an NAACP dinner. For more, we're joined by two Morehouse professors. Dr. Tara Taylor is an assistant professor of sociology at Morehouse College. She turned her back and raised her fist as President Biden gave his commencement speech. And Samuel Livingston, an associate professor of Africana Studies 1990s and a member of Friends of the Congo. Professor Livingston was behind President Biden holding up the flag of the Democratic Republic of Congo as President Biden spoke. We're going to get to Congo in a minute, but I wanted to start with Dr. Tara Taylor. Can you talk about your protest yesterday as the president addressed the graduating class of Morehouse?
Yes. So one of the things that I understood was that there is definitely a contention amongst our community regarding the invitation for Biden, one, to be the commencement speaker, but then on top of that, that he was to receive an honorary degree. Luckily now I can speak kind of freely because some of our information has become public, but the faculty, we were basically divided regarding wanting Biden as a commencement speaker, but we understood that we could voice our discontent, but we were not going to rescind him being the commencement speaker. And so I think at that point, I pretty much already had it in my mind that there was going to have to be some level of protest that I was going to do, and I spoke with other fellow faculty members. But the particular issue was that the students were held to this this rule of what they can do and what they could not do. And so, you know, President Thomas, who's the president of Morehouse College, made it clear that a silent protest was very acceptable. However, any type of disruption would actually cancel the commencement overall. So as a faculty member, particularly one who's very connected to their students, I didn't want to be the reason that basically their commencement stopped. But at the same time, students were frustrated that Biden was selected as the commencement speaker, even though they didn't agree that he was receiving an honorary degree from Morehouse. We also had faculty that also was very much disappointed in the way that it was handled by our administration in terms of selecting him and giving him an honorary degree. So it was a moment where I realized that I was going to be at the commencement because I am a student marshal and I wanted to be there to support my students. But I wanted to take it upon myself to, one, stand up for my principals and then also kind of sign a solidarity for my students as well as my other fellow faculty members who felt that we were caught in this moment where it seemed like we as a community selected Biden when we all did not.
And can you talk about D'Angelo Fletcher, the psychology major, the valedictorian's call for an immediate ceasefire, standing before really the world, because this was being broadcast by many news outlets around the world, and then also President Biden calling for immediate ceasefire, Dr. Taylor?
Yes. So I was proud of Fletcher. He wasn't a student of mine, and I also understood the mounting pressure for these students basically to make a statement or not to make a statement. And the young man, even as he spoke, he said he was a little bit nervous about being the valedictorian, knowing that he would have to give a speech. I mean, if anyone who's ever done public speaking can understand, you know, everyone's there, your family's there, you don't know what your nerves are going to be, but now this heightened moment. And the fact that he made the statement and there was some divide even amongst the students that he took this moment to basically use his platform to make a statement. I was very proud of him. I mean, it brought honor to his fellow peers, but it also brought honor to those of us who stand on the shoulders of Dr. King. Because one of the things that we're also always hearing about being faculty and in community at Morehouse is that this is Dr. King's alma mater and that we should stand up for social justice and humanitarianism. And at the same time, we as a community get another message from our administration in terms of how to not to embarrass the college, to be dignified and to engage in a certain form of respectability politics. So for that young man to take that moment to send that message, I was very, very proud of him.
And to be clear, President Biden called for an immediate ceasefire. Fletcher D'Angelo called for a permanent ceasefire.
Exactly. And to me, it was pandering, and it was the moment. And it's also the conflict of basically this is a commencement speaker for the students, and he's using it as a campaign stage. And so even to the extent that he recited off several things that he did for the Black community, for me, while I was standing there with my fist raised, I was shaking my head because I was just like, this is typically what we see, campaign, like trolling to an extent, pandering to an extent, and these are this young men's future. One of the things I couldn't help but notice that there are basically the Secret Service there with snipers right? So there's also the idea that black men who face incredible injustices and policing and harm to their bodies, in their moment of graduation, their moment of celebration, they're also being refined to being repressed and the threat of possibly being harmed if they speak out in protest. So, you know, Biden's statements to me were kind of pretty much very hollow and fell on deaf ears.
Dr. Tara Taylor is assistant professor of sociology at Morehouse College. She turned her back on President Biden as he spoke at the Morehouse graduation with her fist in the air. Professor Samuel Livingston was also at the graduation, associate professor of Africana Studies and a member of Friends of the Congo. Throughout President Biden's address, he was standing in front of the Congolese flag. It was you, Professor Livingston, who was holding up that flag. Can you talk about why and what your demands are?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having us this morning. Actually, it was me and Dr. Cynthia Hewitt who were holding up the flag. And I have to, of course, mention that. But we held up the flag because the police state that Dr. Taylor mentioned in terms of the Secret Service being on campus is local, but it's also global. We held up the flag because the people of the Congo do not get enough media attention in terms of the act of genocide that the United States is supporting, through its support of Rwanda, through its support and Rwanda's support of the M23 rebels. So we have been standing in solidarity and working with Congolese organizations. And I say I've been working with them for about since 2012. But I've been concerned about the Congo since about 1987, as I began my journey of being an Africana Studies professor. And we it's plain and simple, there are so many Congolese people who could speak to their case. But the U.S. media, most of the major newspapers, most of the corporate media will never feature them. So I'll mention Dr. Kennedy Kihangi Bindu, one of our partners who we brought to Morehouse College from the city of Goma at the University of the Great Lakes at Goma. He came to Morehouse and spoke about the situation in the Congo at one of our symposia. We've had a sustained engagement with the Congo that will not show up always in terms of protests, but that type of engagement is transformative with our students. Mm-hmm. We also have a program where we pair our Morehouse students in our first year experience courses with Congolese students, and they engage in conversation. So I think that's very important. We also recognize the connection of the Congo to the current situation in the Middle East. The fact that President Biden has tried to strike a deal with Dan Gertler, the noted conflict mineral mining magnate, who's also Israeli, and who has been using those profits in many ways. Those have gone to enrich him, but also vicariously the Israeli state, and therefore the oppression, contributing to the oppression of Palestinian people. So those connections are there, and we've raised the flag, we held up the flag, because we couldn't rely on just a chant, mm-hmm. because that could be ignored. And even if we gave an interview, maybe not like this one, but with the New York Times, for example, New York Times gave a story on the fact that there had been no protests at HBCUs, or relatively few. And, you know, I was really misquoted in terms of Joe Biden seems like a decent person. But I know, why am I saying that again? I shouldn't be even saying it again. But compared to Donald Trump, I guess anybody could be a decent person. But he does not get it. He does not. He may have the Dr. King bust in the Resolute desk or at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, but he is not listening to King. He needs to listen to HBCU faculty who really have held out the only hope of real social change in America in its history, especially in the 20th century. But we could go back even further. So we held the flag for those reasons. Congo deserves justice, reparations from the United States for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, conspiring in that assassination.
5 seconds.
And yes, and the people today deserve a country that is built on peace and justice.
Samuel Livingston and Tara Taylor, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.